Oh, I didn't know that.
And on our way there, we heard that. Where are they? They're gone. The minute they see you guys, they just left.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard.
He's like, I think we should go now.
I was in the middle.
I think we should. You know, they did one of these. They're about to speak, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, guys, you should see this. This is not good.
Yeah.
Damn. That's not ending. That's like a continuance of humanity just kept pouring in, kind of like in this picture, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I was, what's that, a picture of the State House?
Of the State House with a lot of people.
Well, we'll get back to that in a second, but let me talk about that rally. When was that, 2 years ago? So what? So the alt-right, as they call Nazis now, which I really hate.
I want to say it was 2017.
Yeah, so they showed, 2, 3 years ago. So okay. they threatened to show, they had a small rally before that nobody knew about, hardly, and they got away with it. They didn't get overwhelmed. And so then they thought that this was a new time that they could do their stuff in public. Remember that? That's how it went down.
Okay, that's how
it went down. There was only like a week or
we
two.
It won't happen again. Then they said, we're going to do this time. This time we were already organized at this point.
Well, they did a small one that had a small counter demonstration. So that I think that emboldened them, plus Trump and all that. And then they said they were going to do it again. And this is where within a week or two, and I didn't know it was going to be that big, but I knew it was going to be big. 40,000 people, it turned out, mobilized. And this is all in the media. You could find this out. I was in the middle. By the time I got to the common, they were gone, long gone.
Yeah, me too.
But the thing was that...
We were...
Oh, there was so many people.
We were ants. We were like, let's go.
I was part of a social contingent of 1,000. 1,000 socialists there. So...
You told me that you were like, where are they?
Oh, I was ready to rock and roll. Are you kidding? Are you kidding?
Where'd he go?
It was time.
You said, it's him. It's one of them. You know, let's go there.
Somebody else said that, right?
Yeah.
So what was happening was the entire common was filled with people like me, kind of walking around frustrated that we didn't get to, like, you know, show them what we really thought. And, but apparently there were still one or two of them around, and somebody would identify them, and the crowd would surround them, some people would. And I didn't get in on any of that. I kind of ran up to one of them.
Because you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That was weird. Yeah. I ran up to one of them, and it was a dispute between people from the march, like good people, defending them because they weren't, like you're saying, they weren't 100% sure. And then there were other people saying, no, I know. I knew who they are. So I don't know. I didn't want to get into that. But and it's not just a couple people. A group is different. Although, I don't know. I don't know if I made this thing. If there was one Nazi that got up on a street corner and started saying their stuff, I think I'd go after them.
Yeah, that's like that guy that said the N-word. Well, a lot of us who are, you know, African.
Where was that? Oh, you're the march.
On
the same march.
On the way to Tremont Street going from Dudley, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
Because I saw people, like, plotting. I thought it was a very popular march.
No, there was a certain group there, certain people scattered around that. You know, it was so much.
That.
It was so amped. You would see it like,
wow,
you know, but it'd be calmed down right away. Whoosh, or what you call me?
Yeah, yeah.
Right there, you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
I'm sorry to hear that because the beauty of that day was that if you were there, you realized who the majority really was. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So, they make them seem bigger.
And then
like,
what's his name? Walsh.
But, Walsh
went back and forth.
He got
right?
the right to.
Do you remember that? No. He went back on that. He goes right to protest. He goes from that
in
position.
In a peaceful order.
Yeah, he did that. Then he went back on and said, don't show up, don't come. And then he was mad because at the very end, like an hour after I left or something, some people got in a scuffle with the cops, which it was the cops probably that did it. And then he got back on his high horse. Oh, law and order, blah, 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 you know. Yeah. The guy said, just blows with the wind. He just blows with the wind.
He threw a bottle of water at one of the cops.
Yeah,
and then
I don't know what happened.
It was like
it looked stupid.
Yeah.
But Walsh jumped on it, though.
It wasn't the majority.
But they don't like people protesting. I mean, bottom line, they prefer if we weren't on the streets. But once they realize we're on the streets, they try to usurp it. They try to take it over. Yeah. That's the Democrats.
He tried to look like the mayor who cares for the working class, like Mayor.
Well, he comes from a labor background, but he joined the Democrats, and he's making the big bucks and all that, and it's a joke now. Hey, this is WMFO Medford, WMFO in Medford. That's our legal identification. We're also known as 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. That's community-based, commercial-free. We like that radio. We're a little slice of that community base. We are socialist radio here every other week from... 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And this week is myself, Jeff Booth, and...
Diego.
And, so we've been talking about cheapo billionaires, rotten, evil Darth Vader billionaires. And now we're talking about a very important thing we want you to show up to. We want you to participate in this. 1 p.m. this Tuesday. I know you say you're working. I'm working too. I'm going to take a long lunch, we'll say.
Unfortunately, I can't leave lunch.
You can't leave this place?
I'm a cashier.
Yeah.
All that day.
Do you get any sick days?
Anyway. I will soon when my cataracts get
operation. Oh, yeah, you use your sick days. Never mind. Anyway, if there's any way you can get there, 1 p.m., State House steps, that means that building with the gold dome, no accident there, that it's gold, right?
It's probably not gold.
Well,
I don't think it's
the
gold.
Symbolism I'm talking about.
I'm going to go up there one day, try to melt it, see if I can get some gold.
What's the symbolism?
Get arrested right away.
Gold has blood on it. Every piece of gold is gold from slaves and miners being exploited and et cetera. Anyway, 1 p.m., major rally for rent control. Now, specifically, lift the ban on rent, state ban on rent control. Now, there is more than just a rally going on. From 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., I assume with a break for the rally, there's a hearing, they call it, going on where if you want to, you can go and shout at the Democrats, or at least certain Democrats, about the need for this. I don't like, personally, whenever you're listening to our show and our ideas, lobbying is not at the top of the list. I think what we do is we get so many people together that they got to hear us no matter what. That we occupy the state house. We're so loud. We go on strike, general strike. Things shut down. I don't want to lobby the class enemy for anything. I want them to just feel like they better do what we want or else. That's what I want. That's not lobbying. That's threat. That's a threat, a political threat. And I say that openly. We have a political threat here. Do what we want or it's going to be a general strike or a big strike. Do what we want, you're going to have a protest on your hands that's going to make the one we were just talking about look like nothing, you know? We don't want to lobby. But anyway, if you want to go in and they are urging people to do this and talk, yada, yada, at the politicians, you can do that, too, from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., probably with a break for the rally at 1 p.m. I'm trying to get people out to the rally. Bodies, show your body, show your mind out there. Talk to your people that you're with out there.
I would
there.
Be more of a get all the homeless people in a sit-in.
Yeah.
A sleep-in.
Yeah.
In those state house.
It's hard to organize homeless people, but I understand. I get what you're saying. In this case, I mean, the group that we're in, independent socialist group, will be out there. There'll be a lot of different groups out there. It'll be good. What else to say about that? We explained what it was. If you're turning in late, what happened was 20 years ago, they couldn't get rid of rent control. 25 years ago, they couldn't get rid of rent control in Cambridge, Brookline, or was it Northampton or something?
Yep.
And
places.
And but they had gotten rid of it through a lot of pressure, a lot of big money coming in, and in some places like Boston, Cambridge, Brookline. Not out west. I don't think it existed out west. It might have. I don't think so. Like Somerville lost rent control in like 78 or something, which is ridiculous. Somerville needed rent control so bad. So it still does. But rent control, you got to understand, is popular. All the lies they told about rent control, like rich people living in apartments that have rent control. That was their line. That was a tiny, tiny minority of people that just stuck around for a long time. And yeah, so maybe they got some money finally, and then when they're old, and they're not rich really, and they got an apartment, they could afford a better apartment, but they liked that one. Nothing wrong with that. Problem was the rent control was so constricted by then, they kept chopping away at it, that they made it sound like, and it could look a little bit like, you know, a scarce thing. So a scarce resource taken up by people that could afford better in a few places. That was their line. It wasn't really true. But they painted that picture. So you had some idiots out in wherever voting against rent control, voting for the state ban on rent control, basically. But it was all confusing, a lot of big money behind it. I think now people are educated, let's say. A little more educated about what high rents mean.
By events, not by,
yeah, by events, yeah, yeah. So anyway, show up to that rally Tuesday, I would say 1 p.m. at the State House.
That's like everybody asked Park Street me, where do you live? I live in Cambridge.
Subway.
Like, what?
Yeah, how can you afford it, yeah.
I'm like, oh, you got to be rich then. You must be making six figures.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just, knock on wood, fortunate that I have a landlord who paid his mortgage since the 70s.
Yep.
And he doesn't eye gouge me, you know, with the rent. Plus, I'm all, you know, I help out with the property. You know, he's older gentleman.
Yep.
With you know, when he goes on his vacation, I'll do the trash. Yep. I'll do the, you know, also if it snows, I do the, you know, shoveling of the property.
Yep.
So he keeps my rent favorably, you know.
Yeah.
Online.
Yeah, I had a friend in Southie that was.
But that can change any moment.
He had a landlord that's just old school landlord, didn't want to raise the rent, you know.
Lord forbid he passes away. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know.
That can
I understand.
Change dramatically. I am not here talking about.
And East Cambridge, where you live, is getting gentrified.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the guy who's going to take over, his nephew, will be like, yeah, I'll sell the place, get out, and we'll just make this, you know, and sell the place for millions.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There's places in Cambridge still where they have public housing. There's places where there's substandard housing. It's a big city, but most of it is beyond the reach of working people. Unless you want to live like a student, like in an apartment, well, a rich student, in an apartment with like six roommates or something, you can't live there. You just can't. Part of it is the universities. Part of it is just, the universities are part of capitalism. But, you know, part of it is the stuff you can think of about real estate and gentrification and all that. But part of it is in addition, in Boston, whenever you talk about housing, or most parts of Boston or Cambridge, you're talking about the influence of big universities on the housing stock, so to speak, or on the housing market, so to speak. They take up a lot, and they buy up more and more, and they become landlords. I got a great story for you. Harvard owns a certain amount of housing, right? I work at Harvard University.
I thought they own like half of a city, don't they?
Maybe. I don't know the extent of their holdings, but I know that they have housing. And back
in Alston, too, they've had a lot of housing.
Yes, probably, because they just bought up a ton of Alston. A lot of Alston they just bought up. But what I was going to say was like... I was talking to someone at work about this. There's a guy I know at work who, he's single. He just wants to live in Harvard housing, you know? They made this decision way back, like 20 years, like around the time of this, 25 years ago or more, when he was actually at this meeting where Harvard said to the city that we feel it's an obligation of ours to rent our housing units at market rate. Because it's fairer that way. What if we gave cheaper rents? That wouldn't be fair. Because...
This is the Harvard administration.
This is the Harvard administration justifying... The liberals do this a lot. Justifying a draconian, horrible policy in the name of social fairness or good or something. You know what I mean? There's many examples of this kind of argumentation. So he was outraged, of course, and a lot of other people were too, because this is like, you have to be somehow affiliated to Harvard to get access to this housing, like a worker, a grad student.
So they try to be nice.
An alum or something.
Putting this draconian thing in.
No, they're not being nice. They're not being nice at all. They're being the opposite.
The way
nice.
They're saying it.
The way they're saying
it's
it.
It's nice,
yeah.
But in reality, like, won't you, you know, I would have been like, listen, just be upfront with me. Don't say it in a nice tone. Just tell me you need to get out because I want more profits.
They're the landlord, right? They could charge whatever rent they want, including keeping in mind that people that work for them don't have a lot of money. I don't. Students even at Harvard, there's some working class students. Grad students are not the typical Harvard student. They could open it up to non-Harvard affiliates. Maybe they already have. I don't know. They can charge whatever rent they want. They're the landlord. Harvard, you know, all that stuff about Harvard being a nonprofit and all that means nothing. It's a big business. Part of its business is real estate. Part of its real estate business is being landlords to commercial and residential properties. So this guy remembered, because we were talking about this thing. He's going to go to this rally. We were talking about the rally, the rent control rally. And he said he remembered the day that Harvard publicly, of course they were already doing this, but publicly said the reason they keep jacking their rents up is because they think they have to, they said, we want to rent at market rate. Now, in a place like Boston, you might as well say, because we want to shoot you in the head. Because market rate is ridiculous. And this guy matches their rent increases so far. He's afraid he's not going to be able to and have to move. It's just vile. It's just horrible. Harvard has more than enough money. Billions and billions and billions. Like Carl, I wish Carl Sagan was still alive, because he could take the star. Remember Carl Sagan? The scientist, he had a show called Cosmos.
Yes.
And he was famous for billions and billions, because he was trying to make people understand how many stars there were out there in the universe and understand what a billion meant, you know? So billions and billions, and comics would make fun of him for saying that. I wish someone would do that for Harvard. Just try to make people understand Harvard's money. billions and billions and billions. I mean, 43 billion or something like that in the endowment alone. That's not even their operating income. That's not even other sources of income that come in. Just their endowment.
Trillions.
Exactly.
That's close to a trillion.
If you include assets, it's trillion. It'd be over a trillion easily. So, this is wrong. It's horrible. And come to the rent control rally. If Harvard sticks to its word and does market rates, and we get rent control back, and we get some public housing built, Harvard will have to lower its rates, won't it? It won't. I'm making a joke. They won't lower their rates. They'll keep them high.
Don't get our hopes up.
Unless forced. Well, I mean, if there's a movement, like one of the things I've learned from talking to people that were involved, from reading about it, you can start with a narrow issue movement. Like in Chile, it just happened. They raised the transit fares. The people had had enough. It was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Oh, we should learn something on that.
They had huge protests, and they won. But they didn't stop there. They were like, Pinochet's constitution. Is the constitution we're ruled under? Screw that. That's fascism. We don't want that. Boom. They got all sorts of stuff. They got the constitutions being rewritten. They got tons of gains made from this big, huge protest movement, which they desperately needed because the Pinochet regime privatized education, healthcare, everything. It was horrible. They're gaining back some of that stuff now through this huge protest movement. And it's still going on, I think. I mean, not necessarily a big protest, but still a big battle to follow through.
Within the assembly.
Yeah. Politically, like on the streets and the left and trying to make the left really be the left and all that kind of thing. The point is that that was an example, one of many. Like when you go back and read about the last mass movement, really real mass movement in U.S. history, the movement against the Vietnam War and all the things that came out of that increased. The women's rights movement was reignited. The civil rights movement became the Black Power movement. You know, the Black Panthers and so on. And the tail end of the civil rights movement too, under MLK before he was assassinated, and Malcolm X before he was assassinated. And what else? The environmental movement, Earth Day and all that, you know? All these other big movements came out. So pretty soon you had it, like we were talking about earlier, it affected scholarship. I mean, all sorts of so-called scholarship, all sorts of things, you know? It became an overall big thing. If we had rent control, if we won a big victory on rent control, people might start thinking about other things, you know, like Harvard housing, or, you know, they might start thinking about why does it cost so much to buy food, and why does it cost so much to get cars repaired, and why are we paying so much for the tea, and, you know what I mean? Like, these things could start to domino effect in a good sense, you know? I hope that's the way it goes. As socialists, we're always looking at the broader connection between issues and also their root cause of capitalism and the exploitation and waste and so on under capitalism. Speaking of which, we're gonna talk now briefly, if it's all right. This is not happening in Boston, but in Worcester, but that's pretty close. It's a meeting, a public meeting, second public meeting of a new socialist group called Independent Socialist Group. And it's A Socialist World is Possible is the name of the meeting. And it's an international speaker. It's the one thing that makes this meeting a little different. A couple things, but this is a public meeting hosted by the Independent Socialist Group, but we're having an international speaker named Hannah Sell. Now, Hannah Sell wrote one of the best books I've ever read about explaining Marxism in terms that anyone can understand. And it's called Socialism in the 21st Century, The Way Forward for Anti-Capitalism. The first edition came out during the anti-capitalist movement of the early 2000s. And the second one came out in 2006. First edition, 2002. Second edition, 2006. It's a brilliant book. I use it a lot in basic discussions when organizing people into socialism. And she'll be the featured speaker. She is currently the Deputy General Secretary of the Socialist Party of England and Wales, which is part of the Committee for Workers International. She's the author of Socialism in the 21st Century. She was previously the elected youth representative on the Labour Party's National Executive Committee in England, back when they had a youth representative. So that was a big deal. She was quite young when she had that position. She was the National Secretary of Youth Against Racism in Europe and a National Committee member of the Labour Party Young Socialists back when that existed, when the Labour Party was more radical. I asked somebody who's active in the Socialist Party, actually, and I didn't get an answer yet. When Corbyn got back in power, remember that for years you had like Blair, then blah blah, then Miliband and Kinnock and all these right wing labor people trying to turn the Labor Party in Britain into the Democratic Party. It never succeeded fully, but they tried. Then a guy got in. Then when Ed Miliband lost an election, they were like so depressed. They were like, well, to get more members, we're just going to open up, let regular people join, which is what it used to be in the Labor Party. So they said, you pay £3, you're in the Labor Party. And people jumped at it. The average, young people, all sorts of people were like, okay, yeah, £3, you're in the Labor Party in Britain. Because it's the Social Democratic Party. It's not like the Democratic Republican parties here. It's very, very different. It had a history way back, at least, and certain times since then of doing real left-wing politics, right? And out of that base, Corbyn gets elected as a real left-winger, heading the British Labour Party. He just recently lost an election to a right-winger. They lost. But I wanted to ask, in that short term, that short period of time, three years, when Corbyn was the leader of the Labour Party before the election, the national election, did they go back and reestablish the Labour Party Young Socialists? Did they go back and reestablish neighborhood Labour Party groups, you know, and all that stuff? I don't know the answer to that. I don't think they did like a full scale reorganizing of the Labour Party like they should have the way it was organized originally as a revolutionary party. No, originally, like in 1904 or whenever. It was a social. When I say Social Democratic Party, when I say Social Democratic Party, the code I'm using, and I should explain it, is a party that started off as a truly revolutionary party that wanted to overthrow capitalism and implement socialism. Now, not everyone hears that knows about Social Democratic parties, because now they're compromised so much in many countries that they're actually pro-capitalist. Mm-hmm. And they've been in power, like PSOE in Spain, for example. They've been in power and they've implemented capitalist everything, laws, regulations, legislature, cuts, austerity, war. They've done all that rotten stuff, and so it's like, they're not really.
Once World War One happened, like some of these social democrats,
a lot of them,
credits.
Way back then, yep. World War One was
Kotsky.
World War One took a lot of, like you're describing, a lot of social democracy rightward to the point where it was unrecognizable as social democracy. But as late, even after World War One, there were still left wingers involved with it.
Oh yeah, no. World War One, you had a Soviet Union.
But even after World War One, so for example, Lenin. Yeah. Lenin
criticized Kotsky for doing.
Oh yeah, absolutely,
betrayal.
Absolutely. But what I'm trying to say is that the Social Democratic parties turning into pro-capitalist parties was a process, and an uneven one. So there were times, even when it was clear they were not really revolutionary anymore, they still had a lot of left wingers in them. That real left wingers, like the Bolsheviks in Russia and so on, before Stalin took over. They still wanted to talk to those workers. They still wanted to be influence those parties. And so after World War II, there was a short period of radicalization of the Labour Party where they got national health care and stuff and won over Churchill. I mean, beat Churchill down in an election. Then in the 80s, the militant part of the Committee for Workers International, the Socialist Party, in England and Wales, nicknamed militant at the time, they forced the party leftward in a big way, and others, but mostly them, and that could have turned out differently. Unfortunately, a right winger named Kinnock, and eventually working with Thatcher, believe it or not, pushed the Labour Party rightward again. You end up with Blair, total right winger by Labour Party standards, etc. Anyway, don't want to go into the history of the Labour Party too much. Just wanted to say that. Back when Hannah Sell had these positions in the Labour Party, the speaker of this public meeting, it was in a left wing period where it was trying to rediscover its revolutionary roots. And at that time, they still had a constitution that said we should take over the economy for socialism. I'm simplifying, but that's what it said. Clause 4, an enabling clause of actually spelling out how you would go from capitalism to socialism. That was their goal, one of their goals. Who got rid of that, was it? I think it was Blair got rid of that. Just got it out of the Constitution. A Socialist World is Possible public meeting hosted by the Independent Socialist Group. And this will be Wednesday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m. in the Grace Conference Room at Clark University. So that's A Socialist World is Possible. Hannah Sell of the Socialist Party of England and Wales, international speaker, Wednesday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m. in the Grace Conference Room, Clark University. Everyone is welcome. The last public meeting we had was well attended. And I'll read some of the leaflet here for the meeting. If you want more information, by the way, go to on Facebook, Worcester Independent Socialist Group. There's a Facebook page for this actual meeting, A Socialist World Is Possible. There's a phone number, 508-335-8633. That's 508-335-8633 to talk to Independent Socialist Group, get information about the meeting and information about becoming a socialist, whatever. And you can also email Independent Socialist Group, all one word, independentsocialistgroup@gmail.com. And then there's a thing with a phone number, a phone number link, a picture of a phone, right? And then a link, https://worcesterorganizer.wordpress.com. Anyway, lots of ways to get in touch. And just a quick intro to the meeting, subject of the meeting, 2020 promises to start as 2019 ended with global protests and capitalist instability. And we were talking about some of this with the Chile protests, right? Capitalism is now more unequal than ever and is a system dominated by a billionaire elite, which we were also talking about, the billionaire elite, which has become less and less answerable to the workers of the world. One thing is certain, revolts will continue as long as this system does, meaning capitalism. Worldwide, governments are unstable, even in so-called developed countries, quote-unquote. The global capitalist system never really recovered from the economic crisis of 2007-2008. Governments have been forced to use heavy-handed repression as they struggle with social, political, and economic crises. In the past year, workers in one country after another have risen up against dictatorships or threats to democratic rights. A wave of revolutionary protests engulfed Latin America, from Chile and Bolivia to Ecuador, Argentina, and Brazil. A mass movement in Algeria, particularly young people, demanded political rights and improvements in living standards. In Iraq, which in the past was mired in religious and ethnic conflict and plagued by terrorism, workers have risen up to demand jobs and democratic rights. This is before Trump did his thing, right, the Trump administration. Last 2 years, anyway, then it goes on. I'm going to skip a little bit. There have also been upheavals in Sudan, Lebanon, Haiti, Hong Kong, France. In France, the fury of the workers was seen in 1 million-strong demonstrations embracing all sections of the working class. Railway workers, teachers, air traffic controllers, and many others who marched through the streets chanting, "The streets will always be ours." In the U.S., the Trump regime has the deep crisis of the threat of impeachment. This was written just before the war. War threat, you have the war threat on top of that. But without mass resistance from workers and youth, the U.S. ruling class may use the threat of a new war overseas, oh, it was written around the same time, sorry, to strengthen Trump's administration. Join the Independent Socialist Group for a discussion with Hannah Self from the Socialist Party of England and Wales on international developments, the need for international socialism, and the role of American workers and youth, the role they must play in the worldwide struggle. So I'm going to be there. We're both going to be there, hopefully, right?
I hope so.
Maybe.
We'll see. It's a Wednesday. We'll see if I get that day off. But definitely, and that 26th one, I'm definitely going there.
Yeah. And I have another leaflet from Independent Socialist Group. This is about the war, opposed war in Iran and the Middle East for workers' union against imperialism and capitalism. By the way, you can add to the list of countries protesting. Iran itself had these big sort of like economic-based, worker-based protests not long before the bomb, the assassination incident of the general. Who, by the way, was a real, real scumbag. When we talk about that murder, which was it was assassination, political assassination of those two generals.
Three.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Three.
Yeah. Well, the one everyone knows about, the one from Iran, he was. Yeah.
But they're all brothers. Three.
What do you mean, brothers? Like,
I
literally?
Think they're all related.
I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah. So the one from Iran, Khomeini or whatever. He's part of the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard is this notoriously right-wing, theocratic police force in Iran that has done everything from murdering, historically since 1979, tens of thousands of left-wing people, imprisoning women and anyone that doesn't obey the Islamic fundamentalist interpretation they have. Trade union leaders have been arrested, thrown in prison for long, long prison sentences, tortured, disappearances, political disappearances and murders. I mean, they're horrible. But you don't use U.S. imperialism to solve the problems of the world. It just creates deeper problems. And of course, if you look at what the CIA does, what the Trump regime and other regimes, Democratic or Republican, have done with everything from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to post 9/11, all the you know, Abu Ghraib and all that stuff, and the tortures and all that. There's no high horse for either of those those groupings. Some people on the left would say U.S. imperialism being more powerful, that's what you should concentrate on. Well, I mean, I agree theoretically, I guess, but I can't help but say the first people to die from the hands of that general in the Islamic Republic are myself and you and everyone else that's left wing. Yeah. We raise our heads in Iran, they're going to be chopped off right now.
And like you said,
by the Revolutionary Guard.
I was interested how you said it. This is imperialism is not the answer, because now what it
Not at all.
All those protests that were happening that were against the regime
cut across them.
Now they're all kind of going. Not all the protests, but now the government is giving them the government a reason to, hey, let's rally around this.
Yeah.
You know, the death of these three generals.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they touched
anti-America.
They touched the nationalist button, you know?
Exactly.
Every capitalist country, and Iran is capitalist, there's, like we said earlier, there's no accident. They have to have a strong state to enforce the craziness, the insanity of capitalism. I mean, like, how could you have any homeless people where there are so many empty houses and buildings? The only way is that they know, homeless people and their advocates know, if you try to break in, you're going to get arrested. Maybe you'll get shot.
Yeah.
There's a woman that was peacefully occupying an abandoned apartment in Oakland. This just made the news recently, with her kid or kids. Peacefully occupying. She's lifelong native of Oakland. And she refused the landlord's request to evacuate, because the landlord didn't care about the property until he found out through the media that she was purposely occupying the property to make a point, but also because she needed a place to stay. She didn't want to be homeless. I think she had been homeless or something. And so then the courts got involved. And she had a big court case coming up just like 2 days ago or whatever about, can you, a judge, regional, maybe statewide judge was gonna, or maybe just Oakland, I don't know, was gonna say whether or not she could stay. And I knew immediately they were gonna vote, you can't stay, because of the one sacrosanct law in capitalism. Sacrosanct meaning you can't touch it, is private property. And I don't mean someone's house. I mean, they wanna make sure private property on the top of the spectrum, the property that's really social property, big pieces of land, big factories, big chunks of cities and whatever. You know, they want to make sure that either the capitalist state or, more importantly, the capitalist class directly owns that stuff. Because that's what they make their money off of. You can't produce something. You can't deliver something. You can't, you know, grow something, you know, unless you control and own that land, you know, or lease it from another capitalist or whatever. But it's all kept in the capitalist class. So big chunks of property in Oakland, like any other city, are owned by banks, owned by rich landlords. I knew she was going to lose the court case, and she did, unfortunately. She lost it. And everything's tied into that stuff. Like, it's like you've heard about people going to prison because they fake their address. Like, for example, where I live, the school system is okay. But if I want to go to the best school system in the state, it's like the next town over. And then the second best is like two towns over. If I put the wrong address on some forms, I could go to prison for like 10 years or something. You know what I mean? So some poor people have done that, right, in cities. They just, you know, I live on this block, not this block. Yeah. If they get caught, one woman got like 10 years, 7 years in prison or something, just trying to get her kid into a decent school. People are writing about that now. There's sociologists writing about that. Geographical, what do they call it? Geographical capitalism or something. I don't know. They look at things from like zip codes. Zip code can tell you a lot about a person. And it's another angle on basically inequality. It's another angle on, wow, this zip code.
Zoning laws.
This zoning laws would be part of it, yeah. This zip code, yeah, yeah. That's place I have in mind of the best school system in Massachusetts.
There was an episode on All in the Family about that.
Go ahead.
Where Jefferson, he's as a Republican. Archie's like, shocked, you're a Republican? Yeah, I want your vote, you know, blah, blah, blah. He wants to get into the council. And he all wanted to do it because he wanted to change the zoning law where he can break his, he had a shop, I think. He had his own laundry. He wanted to expand his business. So he's trying to get into the council to do that. And it ends up being that, no, you're in a different zoning law that you know, he was doing this for nothing anyway. It was a little funny. It was like, you know, funny, but at the same time talks about the zoning laws, you know? This is how great the shows were in the 70s, more conscious.
Yeah, I know.
Compared to now, you get stuff that's like, what
you know,
are
did
we
you
watch?
Know that they did a reboot of the Jeffersons or something, or of the Good Times? They did it was going to be shown live.
No.
Did you hear about this?
No.
I don't have the details, so I think I even saw like 2 minutes of it. Hey, by the way, to that list of countries in having huge protest movements, we're going to add India. And the French protest movements, and some of those countries listed, the movements still continue.
Oh, yeah, they were burning banks yesterday.
That's not the main thing they were doing. Yeah, it was part of it.
Well, I seen a bank on fire, you know, I was like, I'm watching RT, they got this little thing. They always
yeah, but why is that
happening?
The only thing you see? I mean, this is like...
Why is the only thing? Because RT's the only one that actually reports this stuff.
They like the violence. If it bleeds, it leads. No, this is a mass movement in France. This is really good. I mean, this is like week after week, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people on strike. It's pretty, pretty amazing. And wonderful.
It's been going on for a year.
And they forced the government now.
More than a year.
No, this is not the Yellow Vest movement. There's some involved from that. This is a new movement that started about a month ago, maybe, of mainly led by the unions, the CGT and some more kind of reformist unions. Why don't we get into that, actually, in a minute? But first...
India?
First India, because I started to talk about that. Largest ever strike in India shakes up Modi government. This is from an article by Zubad Varma, January 8th, 2020. India woke up on January 8th let me start with another article that is written from Vijay Prashad, who's an activist I know of, and he's going to be like kind of trying to make this more understandable than that other one, which is more of a local thing. But anyway, Alan McLeod, Vijay Prashad, I think shared this, McLeod, January 8th. An estimated 250 million people in the country of India, roughly 3% of the world's entire population, went on strike today on January 8th across the subcontinent of India, protesting the government of Narendra Modi's racist and anti-people and anti-worker policies. The protests were called by the Center of Indian Trade Unions, and are thought to be perhaps the largest strikes in world history. They keep using the word protest and strike together, which I think is, maybe it was January 7th. It was January 7th or January 8th. Because I just saw a picture of January 7th. Here's one on January 8th. Anyway, I'd say strike. They're using both words to describe what happened. But strikes that were so big, they kind of turned into protests as well. The CITU, that is, of course, what I just mentioned, Center of Indian Trade Unions, has a 12-point charter of demands they've put to the government. They include the following. Urgent measures to contain price rises through a universalized public distribution system. Wow. And banning of speculative trading on the commodities market.
Yes.
A job generation scheme to combat India's unemployment problem. That's a little vague, but okay. Stricter enforcement of all basic labor laws. I doubt that will happen. Universal social security. There you go. There we go. A minimum wage of at least 15,000 rupees or $210 per month, approximately $210 per month. A guaranteed pension for the entire working age population. Equal pay for equal work. The stoppage of a pro-employer anti-labor laws. The end to direct foreign investment in key industries like rail, defense, and finance. Because Modi's continuing a policy of privatizing things that used to be publicly owned, at least, or, you know, at least in name in India. So privatization happening, more capitalist exploitation. Many on the streets are also continuing the protest against Modi's privatization schemes and racist CAA and NRC acts. The CAA explicitly prevents Muslims, India's largest religious minority numbering around 140 million people, from neighboring countries to acquire citizenship in India. The NRC, National Registration Council, overturns all previous citizenship laws requiring all Indians to provide extensive documentation to prove their citizenship, something hundreds of millions will surely be unable to do because of the poverty and so on. It therefore gives Modi and his ruling far-right Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, the ability to remove citizenship and therefore virtually all human rights from any Indian it wishes. The government has already removed nearly 2 million people's citizenship in the northeastern state of Assam, around half of them Muslims. It is also currently building a network of detention centers similar to those used by ICE in the U.S. to house the newly criminalized population of, quote, illegal immigrants, unquote. In many cases, it is employing those same people to build their own prisons. The strike is supported by most major unions except those affiliated with the ruling BJP. It also has the support of the Indian National Congress Party, which ruled the country for decades after its independence from the UK.
Wow, they're continuing the caste system, that government.
Yeah. Rahul Gandhi, leader of the party, of the Congress Party, until August last year, also estimated that 250 million people would be on the streets tweeting, and then they have a Twitter thing link. One industry expected to be hit particularly hard is banking, blah, blah. Okay, anyway. A common tactic of the strikers across the country is to occupy railway lines, shutting down India's most important and iconic transport network, effectively paralyzing the country. Representatives of India's coal mines also announced that its 600,000 members, coal unions, I'm sorry, that 600,000 members, remember that? Imagine that, a union of 600,000 miners? Wow. Would join the strike despite an order from the management of Coal India Limited not to do so. Many of the enormous country's population of agricultural workers are expected to down their tools as well. Now, did you hear anything about this in the media? You said
no.
You had? No, I didn't.
No, no, the France thing I did. But,
yeah, not
that,
India.
No, I'm sorry. It was on Democracy Now.
Oh, yeah, good.
So I did see that.
I didn't. This
it
is,
was mentioned.
This is from, I don't even know where this is from. I don't have the citation. Let's see. Countercurrents.org. This is really good. They get into this right now. They say, oh, this is funny. We were just talking about this. I didn't even know this was in the article. A search for India strike into Google news search engines as of 2300 India Standard Time, in other words, after an entire day of striking, produces just one result from a Western news organization, a short article from Reuters claiming that only tens of thousands are on strike. While numbers for simultaneous demonstrations happening across the subcontinent can never be gauged completely accurately, what is striking is the complete disinterest in such a huge revolt from international media organizations. Well, I found that with the French stuff, it took a long time for them to start reporting on it, and they're still not reporting on it much. So this is a really good article worth reading. Alan McLeod is a staff writer for Mint Press News. Maybe this was from Mint Press, but it also was from that one I just mentioned, Countercurrents. Anyway, so India, that's, second most populous country in the world, still a ton of industry and so on. Capitalism and the gut-wrenching hijack of India, another article, don't really have time to get into, by Colin Todhunter from, the one we already talked about, counterpunch.org. And then the Countercurrents article, another Countercurrents article, countercurrents.org, which I'm not even sure what Countercurrents is, but it's pretty, it seems influenced at least by left-wing ideas. And this is an article from January 8th, 2020, largest ever strike in India shakes up Modi government. So it goes into a little more detail about the sectors that were out. Statistics about India, really good stuff actually, which I hope we can get to. I'll try to remember we didn't get to that, so for the next show we can get into that more. Back to France. So the big news in the French strikes, if anyone, any of our listeners have been following them, is they've been huge. They've been led by unions but brought in all sorts of workers, including non-union workers, all sorts of different unionized sectors of the workforce as well. And they've been going on for a long time, and a while, and in terms of big strike time, usually that lasts a day or two, 3 days, a week.
Oh, no, not France.
And it's not the Yellow Vest movement, but there are Yellow Vests, Gilets Jaunes people involved. It's mainly led by the unions, CGT being the most militant, most well-organized union, but also some of the more reformist unions. And that's important to remember because they've already won a concession, a huge concession. One of the things that Macron, this clown for the rich that runs the country, the prime minister or president or whatever his title is, he started this, his administration started this pension reform, they call it, What it really is they want to weaken pensions, make people work longer for less money, all that kind of stuff. So they were going to increase the pension age to 64 or 62 from 60 or 64 from 62. I can't remember which it is. And they just backed off from that. But the way they backed off from it, this just happened within the last 24 hours. The way they backed off from that, or last 48 hours, they backed off by saying, for now, they're backing off. They're going to re-examine it again in April. So what I've read so far, and it's going to be changing even as we speak, there's still the protest movement will continue. People aren't buying the concession as a real concession, or one they should stop striking over. You get to the point as a left-winger, or as an activist, a union activist, you know you're stronger out on the street. Everyone knows it, and yet they still fold up these protests soon, too soon, in many, many, many cases. And it's wrong, but there are other factors you have to, you know, wonder.
So about here or in France?
Everywhere, 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 everywhere. There's a crisis of leadership on the left and of unions everywhere. And it's because some of it's genuine, like how long people really stand to be on strike before they, you know, might lose their jobs or something bad would happen or whatever. Not understanding that having a mass strike changes the rules. So I'm not saying that's a good argument. I'm just saying it's an argument that's something that you do have to worry about when you're a leader. But also, like, they're so used to taking concessions that they can't imagine an outright victory a lot of the times. They do happen, like in Chile, right? But they... Anyway, so the France thing might not... The point of that, raising that, is the France thing might not continue as it should. Because you could see some of the more conservative union federations might break off. There's still like three union, big union federations. Or anyway, here's an article from socialistworld.net, January 7th. France, battle over pension rights threatens Macron presidency. It's got like a lot of pictures of big demonstrations. The mass strike movement in France against government attacks on pension rights is now the longest since the Revolutionary General Strike of 1968, which is something we talk about a lot, right? France 68. Yep. After more than a month, it has lasted longer than the public sector strike of 1995 that ended in 1995 in the victory over the Chirac-Jupp government. During the holiday break, which we just ended in France recently, train drivers of the National Rail and Paris Underground System maintained their action during the holiday break. Other workers spent time with their families and waiting to see if the obdurate, meaning stubborn government under President Macron, would drop the so-called reforms, which basically means, actually, it's just a step backward, increasing the pension age for all workers, you got to work more years, scrapping early retirement for those in particularly dangerous, hard, stressful jobs. So, for example, think about pension systems, if we had one, which we don't, guaranteed by the government, that, like in France, why would you want to let Macron or anybody get away with saying, like a construction worker can't retire till they're 64? Your body doesn't even hold out anywhere near that too long, you know? You need to retire a lot, but long before that. But so does everybody, to enjoy life, to have a decent life. Plus, we pay in, you know, we pay taxes in France's case, taxes in our case, other money. It's a benefit. We should have pensions. Do you have a pension? Is that part of your benefits?
Yep.
Yeah.
But I got to be there for one more year to be fully invested.
There you go. Yeah, that happens. Do you have to put money in to make it work, or do they put the money in?
Nope. I can put in money if I want, but they put in money into it, and but you have, like I said, you have to be there for 3 years, and then it's yours. If I was to move on to, let's say, Beth Israel, I could take that with me.
Yeah.
If I was to go right now to Beth Israel, I would lose that. That's already accumulated.
Pension stuff is really complicated for no good reason other than they like to keep us confused about it. But watch out. Taxes. Watch out for... They just tear up the pension one day. That's been happening to tens of thousands of workers around the country. Watch out for... for example, the pensions are taxed in such a way in the United States that at any time before... you're due to retire, if you try to take out, like, say you work in one job for a long time, like I have, I've worked up a chunk of change with the pension system because I started when they still had a real pension system. Now they don't have one anymore. And but I'm grandfathered into the old system. Now, with the new system, I don't know which one I'm supposed to get. That's where the confusing part comes in. part of it. There's a lot of confusing things. Anyway, the point of the story, though, is that... So, if I tried to leave that job or I got fired from that job or laid off and I decided to take my pension with me early, the government would tax it 40%. I would lose almost half of it. Just to outright tax hit. There's other taxes, too. When you start to use your pension, you get taxed on it and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like what I needed to do when I got let go from Whole Foods. I had a lot of 401k.
Yep.
And I need that money right away because that unemployment, I don't know if it's going to kick in, when it's going to kick in, and the rent doesn't wait. So I ended up just taking it out, literally, 40%, 35%, actually. Yep. I did the math.
Wow.
It hit me hard. And the penalty. That's not including the penalty.
I didn't know there was a penalty. How much was that?
Yeah. Another $1,000.
Oh, my.
So I got like $2,580-something that I paid 3 months of my rent. Right on, here you go, because I'm basically pretty rushed right now, jobless, and I'm looking, you know? So I have a little, at least got that factor, the roof over my head, you know, out of the way for 3 months while I'm searching.
The landlord must have been really pleased with that big check.
Well, I told him, I said, listen, here you go.
I don't
need the money in my hand. I want you to have it.
I get
it. So you already have me on for this month, this month, this month, and I'm set.
No, I think that's a really smart thing to do. I'm just saying the landlord must have been happy, though.
I'm just covering my ducks because I don't know when unemployment's going to kick in, or if it's going to kick in. Do I have to go to hearings? It already happened with Rite Aid.
Yep.
And I had to represent myself.
Yep.
And
I know.
It went against me, not for me.
Yep.
So.
Back to France. In his New Year's speech, however, Macron made it perfectly clear he had no intention of stepping in to ease the situation. Again, that's changed. Like we just described, there was a concession made, finally, recently, in the last couple days. And a dramatic escalation of the movement is already underway. Let's see. Don't have much time to read this. One of the things they did was they targeted oil refineries within the last couple days, the last few days. So it was reported that five... what's the date today?
Today is the...
11th. Let me look.
10. Okay. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. I should have this... Know what the date is. It is... January 12th.
12th.
So, this is as of... early last week. Reported that that they targeted oil refineries let me just read this real quick. The author of this, I believe, is Claire Doyle, I think is the author. And it's from socialistworld.net. And so there's a subheading called Roll Call. The list of those already participating in these massive strikes includes not only the traditional militants in the form of the dock workers, the factory workers, the depots, deep truck depots and all that for transportation, but also teachers, care workers, telephone operators. I didn't know they still existed. Just before Christmas, striking singers and dancers of the two famous opera houses in Paris showed their determination to fight against their pension rights being undermined. They performed on stage at the protests. Lawyers even are staying home. Now here we get to the oil refineries. This week, because I think that was a brilliant strategy after the oil refineries. This week it was reported that 5 out of 8 oil refineries are not just blockaded, but they're involved in the strike. The workers there are on strike. Workers in the chemical factories are joining in. Last week a collective called SOS Pensions, meaning Help Pensions, announced that its 700,000 members will be joining the protests on the streets.
Next should be the gas stations. We're not serving until we get there.
That would be great.
Hit him with even a...
They just turn off that little self-service thing.
The bourgeoisie. I can't get gas. I don't know if this is resolved.
That would be great. That would be brilliant.
Well, the refineries. Where does the gas come from? It didn't get delivered.
Yeah.
That's it.
No one drove the truck. Remember the workers, people that drive trucks and stuff?
Yeah, they
really exist.
Yeah. They just do it at night, so you're sleeping. Yeah, you don't know that gas station got serviced by a big truck.
Do you ever go by these?
I notice because I get out at midnight, and I'm getting off, and then I see the gas station next to where I live.
Yeah.
Where it was next to that restaurant you like, that Brazilian restaurant.
Moqueca, yeah.
And there's a big truck there, and the guy's just, you know? And I'm hoping he's not smoking a cigarette. It looks like he's like, Jesus.
You know what else is really interesting is that you go by... I don't know why. I don't know if about trucking these days, but you go by certain rest areas on the highway or certain, like, you know, where there's the McDonald's and the stuff like that.
Yeah.
And at certain times of the day at night, there's like
5 or 10 of
500. No, I mean a lot, like 50 trucks or something like that, taking up a space I didn't even know existed, double parked and stuff. And I'm like, what's going on? Is this a meeting or what's going on?
No, they're sleeping.
They're sleeping. Yeah. No, I know. I know.
They
They
got those booths right in the
back. I know. I've known people that have done. But why that time exactly and stuff? I don't know. I think they're maybe sitting out rush hour or something. Yeah. I don't know. But I like. I ran.
It was a layover. They can only drive a certain amount of hours.
Supposedly.
They become drunken with slip. You know, like.
I know some young guys back in the. I knew some young people back in the 80s, when I was young as well. Who became over the road truckers? Three people up in New Hampshire that were in a socialist group I was in at that time, and they all became over the line truckers. But it was non union, unfortunately, and just terribly brutal.
Brutal work.
Yeah, they cheat on those schedules you were just talking about all the time. Not the workers, but the bosses. They say, we've calculated it takes this amount of time to go from point A to point B. Of course, their calculations are bull. They don't take into account. Yeah. Traffic or enough
car accidents,
all sorts of things, fatigue, all the things you're supposed to. They say, you better make it there. You better make it there, or else. Yeah, a break, no break. So it gets to the point where these young guys got so overtired they would spend their own money on a hotel, take an unauthorized break just to try to get some sleep. And it was just a battle, constant battle with the bosses over that stuff.
It's funny because with the unionized companies like Unify, I know a lot of the truckers that I used to deal with when I was at Whole Foods, that the company pays for their hotel. Yeah. It's part of the contract.
This was long haul trucking that used to probably be unionized back in the days of when the teams. Who was it that came in? Oh, yeah, Carter, the Democrats under Carter, when they controlled the White House and the Congress. They came in and deregulated trucking along with a lot of other stuff in the late 70s. That destroyed the Teamsters union base in long-haul trucking. Hasn't recovered yet. Most of the Teamsters are organized as what they call short-haul, meaning, a beer refinery, an oil refinery or something, a beer production place. They'll do the deliveries
every
day.
Yeah, we're not going all the way to the West Coast. Yeah. We're going within the same
daily deliveries,
New England area or whatever. Yeah.
So, anyway, we just ran out of time.
Yeah, I know.
We didn't get to, a lot of stuff, but we got to the main stuff.
Next time.
I wanted to get into the anti-war stuff more. Sorry we didn't. But again, you can go to Facebook, Worcester Independent Socialist Group. You could...
That's our new insignia?
Yeah.
Oh, I like it.
Oh, yeah. I was going to give you one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Here you go. You can... We'll read it. We'll talk about it next time more. There's been a lot of stuff about the war, but we had a good... There's a good protest, and one of the things that was good about this almost war thing, if you want to look for a silver lining, is that the protests against it weren't huge, but there were a lot of them. A lot of people were right away ready to go, boom, this is wrong. They got out on the streets, and I think they keep track of that. They know when people are. There's no people don't want this war. Don't want this war.
Same thing with the whole amping up the whole drums of Venezuela, going to Venezuela, get Maduro out. There was a lot of
nobody wants that. Yeah.
There was a lot of demonstrations I've seen, especially from the Veterans for Peace.
Yep. So we're going to go out with... I'll let you introduce this.
Decisions.
You know more about it.
Decisions by Goody Mob.
And then, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully. Socialist Radio.
3 weeks?
No, 2 weeks. 2 weeks, I think.
Are we the 26th?
Oh, yeah. We might have to miss the next show. Yeah. Sorry. We'll see.
We'll see you in a month.
We'll see what we do with that. All right. Last words.
Keep the struggle up, and keep the struggle up for the new decade and into this new century.
Happy 2020, everyone. Thanks for listening to Socialist Radio. And, get involved with the socialist movement. It does exist.
Decisions.
And Decisions by Goody Mob. All right, here we go.